This is Mark Leach. And this is Inquiry. My returning guest tonight is Andy Neal, writer, rock historian, and we're continuing our conversation about his mammoth biography, Had Me a Real Good Time, Faces Before, During, and After. Andy, it's such a pleasure to be talking to you again. I am so glad we're able, and we're only going to cover a small bit of the book to begin with. This is such a mammoth book. Have you ever written a short book?
I don't think it's in my nature, no. It's. I think you get into these things, and it's a case of exploring it right to the end, and if it takes 300 pages, then it takes 300 pages.
You know, and for people like myself, I love detail and I love the digressions. So I love your writing. Your writing's perfect.
Thank you. And
I think a lot of people who are into rock especially love it. Now, we're talking about the Faces, and we ended the last one just before they formed. And I want to remind people of the personnel who are in the Faces. It's Rod Stewart, who's the front man, Ronnie Lane, Ian Mac McLaughlin. Is that how you pronounce his name? McLaughlin? Yep. And then the drummer was Kenny Jones. Why did the Small Faces come to an end? That was a good band.
Well, it was a case of Steve Marriott had got to the point where he was considered the front person, and the front person, in his words, was always the one that copped the flak if the band started to lose popularity. And so he had this hang-up about the frontman complex, but also I think he was aware that the Small Faces were sort of losing their popularity that they'd enjoyed over the last 3 years or so. And this is all, you know, in his words from interviews, but the reason he gave for leaving the Small Faces is that he felt that, you know, it was a case of the captain goes down with the ship, and he didn't want to do that. He wanted to leave the band on a high, and he wanted to go off and do something a bit different than what the Small Faces had been doing. Because the Small Faces, even though they'd enjoyed quite a bit of popularity in Britain and Europe and a little bit of popularity in the United States, it was a case of he felt that they were saddled with an image that they were sort of like a pop group.
Yeah.
And they couldn't really surpass that or get over that. So by leaving the Small Faces, he felt that he could start anew with a new bunch of musicians and carve out a different niche for himself, and that's what became, of course, Humble Pie.
Now, the other part of the band is from Jeff Beck Group. Jeff Beck Group sort of imploded. It seemed like you write that Ronnie Wood and Mickey Waller were sacked from the Jeff Beck Group, I think, February 1969. Jeff Beck Group plays their last gig. It's in Britain at an all-night show in the London Lyceum. But in the audience was Ronnie Lane, Ian, Kenny Jones with their new friend Ronnie Wood. Why didn't the Jeff Beck Group sort of last longer?
Oh, a whole number of things, really. They had a manager who I'm sure you all know, Peter Grant,
yeah,
who went on, of course, to manage Led Zeppelin. He was very good at sort of becoming, he had a design for them, which eventually he used for Led Zeppelin, just as the case of breaking America, what venues to play and what sort of material went down well with what audiences. And they really, Peter Grant really studied that market by using the Jeff Beck Group. And unfortunately, Jeff Beck was a guitar player extraordinaire, but he wasn't really a band leader, and he found it difficult to keep the band together, whether it was he didn't like the musicians for whatever reason, he had an idea in his head of how the band should sound, or there were personality complexes getting in the way, and for one reason or another the band was sort of doomed really not to have any longevity, which is a shame really, because the Truth album was a fantastic album, was very much the blueprint for that first Led Zeppelin album. And of course, Peter Grant, once the Jeff Beck Group sort of fell into disrepair, Peter Grant took that blueprint and ran with it with Led Zeppelin. But I think it was really just the chaotic management system and just, you know, the personality differences and, yeah, it was all a combination of factors that meant that they weren't going to last that long.
Now, how was Rod Stewart eventually brought on board?
Well, Rod was a friend of Ronnie Wood's. And when Ronnie Wood got together with Ronnie Lane, it was a case of Rod wanting to be... He was curious as to what his friend was up to. And when Ronnie and the rest of the guys were rehearsing down in the Rolling Stones storage basement in South London, Rod would just tag along. He was at a loose end. He would just come along and see his friend, you know, just jamming away with these other guys that he knew from the Small Faces. And eventually he started to sing. It was obvious that he was the missing piece of the jigsaw because, you know, they'd all tried singing. Ian McLagan had tried singing. Ronnie Lane had tried singing. Ronnie Wood had tried singing. But they really needed a confident and distinctive lead vocalist. And, of course, Rod Stewart fit those criteria quite aptly, really. So it was just a matter of time before somebody should ask Rod, why don't you join? And that person happened to be Kenny Jones. And it actually met with a lot of resistance, particularly from Ronnie Lane and Ian McLagan, because they were very wary of what had happened with Steve Marriott. You know, they'd been together for 3 years and they were at the peak of their, you know, their success. And then Steve Marriott decided to leave the group and was a bit of a prima donna. And that was what Ronnie and Mac were worried about, that they were replacing one prima donna with another.
But the other thing, well, before we get into Rod in the band, Rod had a solo career, like sort of from the get-go. And reading about that in your book, you know, I never put that all together while I was alive when they were recording. But he was a really great solo artist already.
Well, that's right. He'd already signed a deal with Lou Reisner, who was an A&R guy for Mercury Records in America, because Lou had seen Rod perform with the Jeff Beck Group in Los Angeles at the Shrine Auditorium, which was a popular venue for the band in those days, and he was very keen to sign Rod to do solo recordings because Rod had told him that, you know, as much as he enjoyed sort of singing blues type rock with the Jeff Beck Group, there were more strings to his bow. He was very much into folk music. He came from a folk music background. And so he'd signed a deal for a four-album solo deal with Mercury Records by the time he came to join the Faces, which, if you look upon it from even then, it was unorthodox. And looking back on their career now, it was very strange because he was signed to one record label as a solo artist, and yet here he was trying to join a band and with a rival record label, Warner Brothers. So there was this dichotomy there, which was later to prove a problem when Rod's solo albums became quite successful.
Well, let's talk about the Rod Stewart album. When you were talking about him liking folk music, when you listen to a lot of the songs on that album, like Old Raincoat, Cindy's Lament, and Dirty Old Town, they're really folksy.
That's right. And I say, quite different to what he was performing on stage, because what he'd been performing in the Jeff Beck Group and then later with the Faces was sort of like good time rock and roll.
Yeah, yeah.
Blues. And
that was their whole onstage gestalt. Was this,
that's
like,
right.
they just sort of threw out the whole serious things and they were just down regular guys.
That's right. So for Rod to suddenly, in the middle of all that, do Dirty Old Town or, you know, Only a Hobo, or those other great tracks are on those early albums, it would have sort of, it's interesting, you know, whether it would have ruined the dynamic or not, but I think the whole thing was to get the audience up, and perhaps that sort of stuff, they felt it would slow it down. Who knows? But, you know, so it was a sort of a musical schizophrenia that was going on there. The Faces on one hand being this good time rock and roll band and Rod doing this sort of introspective folky stuff, which actually wasn't too far removed from the sort of music that Ronnie Lane liked, which makes it interesting later when Ronnie Lane decided to leave the band because he felt that his type of music didn't suit the Faces. Well, in fact, it was very much on a par with the sort of things that Rod was doing in his solo career.
Now, one of the things you do, and I thank you for this, you always talk about the business end of things, too. There's a whole weird story. Warner Brothers Records bought Reprise Records in, in Britain.
Yeah.
Like, what happened? That's a complicated story.
Well, it was the Kitty Warner. They basically amalgamated. Warner started up their music division, you know, because obviously they were a motion picture business. And they started up a division basically to release, like, soundtracks. And they just kept diversifying because they were such a big company. And Reprise had been started by Frank Sinatra and Dean Martin, I think, or was one of the two. And so it came to about 1968-69. Warner basically and Reprise amalgamated, and they also joined up with the Kinney group of companies, K-I-N-N-E-Y, to form a company in the UK, Warner Reprise Kinney, and Warner Reprise in America. And so they were looking to sign new acts because most of the music that had been on Warner's and Reprise had sort of been middle-of-the-road type stuff. Obviously, you had Frank and Dino on
Reprise and
Nancy Sinatra and all that sort of stuff. And then Warner's, you know, you basically had, I think, Doris Day and Dick Van Dyke and all this sort of stuff. So they wanted to get into this new rock market. And so they signed up. They hired a very forward-looking A&R guy called Joe Smith in America, who signed, you know, James Taylor and all these sort of people, you know, in the late 60s. And then they also opened up an office in the UK because they wanted all the best of the British groups to come and join the fold. So you had Family, you know, Roger Chapman's group. You had Fleetwood Mac. Wow. And they were signed to Reprise. And so they were looking for rock acts for the Warner side of things. And that's when Joe Smith, who'd heard Rod with Jeff Beck, he heard that there was this new group called Faces that had formed featuring Rod Stewart on vocals. And he was made aware of the fact that Rod already had a deal with Mercury Records, but he said, if you can work out a deal whereby we can get the Faces for Warner's and it's not going to affect Rod's deal with Mercury, and Rod is singing with a band, then we'll sign them. And that's what happened.
Okay, they signed a three-year worldwide deal. Their first gig, I want to talk about this, because reading about it in your book, it sounded surreal. It's an Air Force base in Cambridgeshire.
Yeah, and something out of Spinal Tap.
And there's like 35 people in the audience?
Yes, this was sort of at the time when they were still in a bit of a state of flux in between the Small Faces and the Faces forming properly. They were sort of just getting together and jamming. And they were doing stuff with Ronnie Wood's elder brother, Art Wood, who'd been in groups in the 60s. And so he formed this group called Quiet Melon, which was Art Wood on vocals, Kim Gardner on bass. I think Ronnie Lane was playing guitar even. I'm not too sure what Ronnie was doing. I'm sure he was playing the gigs. They played just a couple of gigs, more for just for the fun of it, really. And that was that gig. There was an Air Force base, and they needed a band, and they just got booked, I think, probably paid in as much beer they could drink, probably. And that was it, you know. And it was like, you know, the Air Force personnel and their wives just coming for a dance, and these guys were just sort of like the entertainment.
Now, the first album comes out, First Step. Can you talk about that album?
Well, First Step was very much aptly named. It was like, it should have been called First Tentative Step. There was stuff that they'd been rehearsing down at the Stones basement rehearsal studio, plus a few things that they'd written out at Ronnie Wood's house, and it was very much a cooperative thing. I think that was the thing that they were intended to make plain from the start, that it was going to be some sort of democracy. So even Kenny Jones, the drummer, gets a writing credit on one song. I think it was more to do for them to get some publishing and to get some money in, because they were absolutely broke after the Small Faces disintegrated. So the first album's sort of a curious affair. It's got some great tracks on it. It's got some not so great tracks on it.
Well, it has three button hand me down, which is a Faces classic.
It is a classic, even though it's completely copied from a song called "Some Kind of Wonderful" by the brothers. Was it the Soul Brothers? I think they were called.
Yep.
It's exactly the same song. If you go and search it out on YouTube or one of those sites, you'll hear it's even got the same bass arrangement almost.
Now, it's got a song called "Pineapple and the Monkey."
Yes. Now, that's more like a Booker T and the MGs type instrumental. Yeah. Again, that was just sort of an instrumental they worked out where I think a few of them got credited. There's a lovely song in it called "Nobody Knows," which is, I think, Ronnie Lane's song, which Rod sings with him. That's a lovely track. And, of course, "Stone," which was very much influenced by Ronnie's interest in Meher Baba, the Indian mystic, who, was also of interest to Pete Townsend.
That's
they,
right.
They shared that interest, he and Ronnie. And Ronnie later did the song again on the album, the Pete Townsend's first solo album, "Who Came First."
Yeah, Ronnie actually traveled to India, didn't he?
That's right. At just before or just after Meher Baba had died, he went to the gathering that the Meher Baba's following held after Meher Baba had died in early 1969. I think what little money Ronnie had, I think Max says in the book, he blew it all on going to India with his wife. They were that devoted to following Baba.
You're listening to
A lot of the stuff that Ronnie was writing at the time was influenced by that spirituality.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My returning guest tonight is Andy Neal, writer and rock historian. We're continuing our conversation about his mammoth biography, "Had Me a Real Good Time," Faces, Before, During, and After. Now, this I don't understand. So the Faces decide to crack the States first, then Britain?
Well, it comes back to what I was saying earlier about the Small Faces having this image that they were saddled with, which was quite unfair, really, because they were more than just a pop group. But in Britain, the sort of tastemakers, if you like, were very fashion-conscious and very trend-conscious. And the Small Faces were seen as sort of a pop, like a pop group from 3 years before. And most sort of tastemakers or hipsters thought that Steve Marriott was the main force in that band, and he'd gone off and left them and formed his own band. And the Faces were sort of like the dregs of that band amalgamated with this band that were big in America but hadn't really meant much in Britain, the Jeff Beck group. So it was almost like there was a snobbery in a way, if you about that they were sort of like yesterday's news. Whereas in America, which is far more open-minded in terms of what the audiences will listen to and accept, and there's no baggage that comes with it. And because Rod and Ronnie Wood were so well known from their appearances with Beck across America, there was a ready-made audience for them. And the band's manager, Billy Gaff, who they acquired in 1969, who arranged the deal with Warners, etc., he quite shrewdly realized that for the band to survive and thrive, they needed to concentrate on the American market. And so that's what they did. And when the Faces would go to places like the Boston Tea Party or Detroit, they had a ready-made audience because of Rod and Ronnie, and also the more musically astute people knew the other guys from Ichiku Park and Ogden's Nutcon Flake.
Right.
So they could go there and they could win over audiences and without any preconceived notion of, well, these guys are a pop group or these guys are this, that, or the other. The audiences there were happy to accept them as long as they delivered the goods and, you know, got the audience off, especially in a place like Detroit, you know, which was renowned for the audiences being sort of like blue-collar kids who worked on the assembly line, and then in the evening they wanted to get off on a band and you know, so you had all those bands like the MC5 and Alice Cooper and the Stooges had come out of Detroit. So the Faces sort of followed that thing of like getting the crowd off and having a, you know, having a real good time, which was what was fundamental, even from those early days of a Faces show. It was to get the audience involved and to get the band and audience feeding off each other as much as possible.
Yeah, it was this whole lighthearted Devil May Care attitude that seemed different, and it's tough for people to understand that now, than the other musicians at the time came off as very serious. These guys came off as like, yeah, let's have a good time and let's forget about the rest.
Well, that's it. I think that's what marked them out from all those other bands that were treading the boards in the early 70s. You had the hangover of all that psychedelic rock thing of the late 60s. And by the 70s, that had turned very predictable in a way. And a lot of the bands that played at that time, like, you know, even bands like Pink Floyd, you know, they were very much playing for themselves, in my view. You know, they had a light show and they had a quadraphonic sound system, but it was like the audience gets stoned and listen to the band. They don't really interact with them.
Yep.
And so many bands were like that. It was almost like this arrogant attitude of, you know, we've come to play for you and you should be grateful, you know, type of thing. And it wasn't really like a party. It was sort of like somewhere, an event that you attended where you were like a passive observer. You weren't really made to feel like you were made to be part of the event. Whereas the Faces were very much anti that. They wanted the audience to get off and be part of it and sing along and you know, help the band drink their case of wine. They always had a case of Matus Rosé, which they used to send out, you know, the cheapest wine possible.
At
the end of the gig, they'd even tell the audience where they were staying, which holiday, and they were staying. So you couldn't really imagine, you know, Led Zeppelin doing that or those other sort of bands like Mountain or whoever, you know, the more serious band, Savoy Brown, and things like that.
I love the fact that, I think it was Rod Stewart, that at the end of one of their concerts says to the audience, if you ask for an encore, you can't have one. And then there's a pause, and he goes, you have to take three. So don't anybody try to leave. That's their attitude. That was their attitude.
Yeah. It was. It was a laugh. You know, it was lighthearted, and there wasn't much lightheartedness going on in the music scene at that time, you know. And it actually got them a bit of a dirty name with certain musicians who thought they weren't serious enough. They were serious enough, but they didn't have to take it that serious. You know, that was the important thing, and I think that's why they've lasted so well.
Well, there's another.
So
there's
much music from that time hasn't lasted that well.
That's right.
For those reasons. Po-faced.
You talked about how they gave out their room numbers and where they were in the hotel. On one concert with Deep Purple, they gave out Deep Purple's room
hotel. Yeah, that's right. That's the sort of, those are the sort of little stunts they would pull.
Oh, like they hated Holiday Inns. They would take all the furniture out of the room and arrange it in the hallway.
That's right, and it got them banned, to the point that they couldn't check into the Holiday Inn chain anymore, so they started checking in as Fleetwood Mac. And then they would trash the rooms, and then Fleetwood Mac would wonder why they couldn't get any reservations.
Let's talk about the Faces' second album, Long Player. What do you have to say about that?
Well, Long Player was, once again, a bit of a schizoid affair. It was half studio with a few live tracks on side two. It was an improvement over the first album. It was still an album that was sort of suffering from, you know, it was too democratic for its own good, because I think there was also this feeling that Rod's albums were sort of more critical and commercial successes. And this underlying feeling started to grow that perhaps Rod was holding back some of his better stuff.
Yep.
And if you were to make up an album of, say, the killer tracks from Rod's second solo album, Gasoline Alley, which came out at roughly the same time,
yep,
and the best tracks off Long Player, you would have had an absolutely killer album.
Well, was that killer album going to be their next one, and Not As Good As Wink to a Blind Horse?
Yes. they were working up.
Because that has stayed with me and bona fide classics.
Yeah, Miss Judy's Farm, Debris, Memphis.
Yeah.
That is, for many people, the definitive Faces album. It was also the start of their partnership with Glyn Johns in the studio. And Glyn had this Midas touch with the bands he worked with of how to get the best out of them musically. Not just the best material, but how it sounded. So if you listen to all the records he made at that time in 1971, listen to Who's Next and Sticky Fingers, and the early Steve Miller Band albums, they sound fantastic even now. And so Glyn brought that magic ingredient when he came to work with the Faces in 1971. They recorded at Olympic Studios, which was where he liked to work. And the results speak for themselves, really.
Yeah,
when you
I know.
Compare A Nod's As Good as a Wink to the two albums that preceded it, there's no comparison in my view. I just find that it sounds better. The band sound tighter, more focused. You know, a lot of the more sort of like so-so songs had been, you know, discarded. I think Glyn was a good A&R man in that respect, even though he was only the engineer. I think he guided them in what tracks to record. And that was the album that really broke it for them.
That's
it was
right.
The biggest album in America. That was when the Faces sort of moved from, you know, medium-sized halls into arenas and stadiums in the States.
We're completely out of time, Neil, Andy. And
again.
I'm just gonna, I know, but I'm going to ask you, I want a one-word answer for this. Now, I know that Mac McLaughlin is dead. Will there ever be a reunion? Just answer me yes or no.
Maybe.
My returning guest tonight is Andy Neil, writer, rock historian. We've been continuing our conversation. By the way, we've only gotten like through a third of the way of the book through two interviews, maybe not even that. Had me a real good time. Faces before, during, and after. Andy, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. It was good to talk to you again. And hope everybody out there who hasn't bought the book goes out and buys it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.